see any men or diaspora expertise that is government or the immigration countries or even many federal companies from some countries that will be invested in understand better how diaspora can work and how diaspora can use to increase that influence in a particular country? Do you see a demand for development in that field?
As a historian of the diaspora, I would say yes. I know periodically Greece becomes interested in utilizing the power of its diaspora, cultural or economic reasons.
Welcome to a new episode of the podcast series States and Migration in Europe. Today, we delve into the dynamism of diaspora communities and influence on international relations and national politics. We turn our attention towards an international diaspora, one that has woven relatively deeply in the province of Australia, the Greek diaspora. Joining us in the meeting guest, Dr. Alexandra Delios, a researcher from the Australian National University, who has dedicated her academic job to exploring the relationship between migration and politics, with a specific focus on the Greek community in Australia. Alexandra's work is light on how diaspora communities will significance for interest shaping policies and contributing to the political discourse. So Alexandra, welcome and thank you for being here.
Yeah.
This episode will navigate through the journey of the diaspora in Australia, exploring why the move to Australia, the political condition they found themselves in, and the evolution to a formidable force in Australian politics. We will discuss the objectives and achievements, and we will broaden the discussion to other pieces of diaspora and the political influence, such as the Jewish diaspora. Our conversation will also touch for expertise in diaspora politics in an increasingly interconnected world with rising foreign communities in various countries. So stay with us as we unravel all the themes. So, Alexandra, how did you come to study migration politics and the role of diaspora and the Greek diaspora in particular?
I guess my life personally is kind of tied up in the history of the diaspora and post-war immigration in particular. Both of my parents were child migrants from Greece in the post-war era, eventually settling in the northern in Australia. And those questions, cultural identity, belonging, integration, what we mean when we talk about multiculturalism, I think it's been fairly present in real life. And it seems to me, studying Australian history, we've always given up thoughts coming out at the university level, for example, Australian histories, but from that perspective of white colonisation and settlement, and then towards the end we get to the partial immigration there and the introduction of diversity and multiculturalism, which is well created from that. So I'd always been interested in hacking some of our assumptions about diversity, colonisation, the different strains that was in migrants, and what our responsibilities are against a colonial state like Australia.
So it had to do with your family background, and so you think the laws to disrupt the dominant nation or not?
I suppose a lot of my work has been interested in diversifying some of those dominant celebratory narratives around immigration and nearly the contributions of migrants to local law and culture. There are different ways when they still look at migration that doesn't simply look at an exchange relationship, but has to understand agency, how migrants as individual subjects operate within structures that prevail in Australian society. Personal perspective, my parents and my grandparents as well migrated as unskilled labourers to Australia, as many southern European migrants did at that time. They faced structural barriers, and I was interested in unpacking what that meant, why they stayed, why they settled, and how they fit into the body politic, ultimately, and what that means to subsequent generations. Nowadays, we call them hyphenated Australian, that is what it means to be Greek Australian, for example.
And do you think that the dominant Now I was here today in Australia, still based out of this anglo-Celtic identity.
An interesting question. We give a lot of lip service to being successful multicultural nation, but if you actually look at what structures are in place to support multicultural nation, I would argue that it is still overwhelmingly Anglo-Celtic in its institutions. So it's definitely still a monolingual country. If you look at who holds power in most of our major institutions, it's still predominantly Anglo. That would be my answer to that. I'll unpack this a little later in terms of what multiculturalism actually means in relation to ethnic diversity. But often it feels like who is ethnicized is anyone other than an Anglo-Australian, and they circle around what is a core Anglo.
Okay, so let's move with the great immigration into that particular country. Obviously, Australia was taken by British people, and there was no policy to privilege immigrants from England or British powers. But starting after the Second World War, new waves of immigrants arrived in Australia, and the Greeks were one of them. So why did Greeks move to Australia? The Greeks moved to Australia where a lot of those were being displaced in the early 1920s and had been repatriated from Minor Asia to Northern Greece. But those people were very still mobile, nomadic, street zeros in Greece, and eventually move further away, correct?
So I don't know in terms of the literature and what evidence is out there for Asian Minor Greeks being more involved than other Greeks in the diaspora. It's interesting that you would say that. My doubt is that Asian Minor refugees, they did have a difficult time being integrated into the Greek nation state after 1922. And then there was a large proportion of Greeks who did eventually migrate to Melbourne in particular, that were from northern Greece. And of that northern Greeks, they were descendants of Asian Minor refugees. So maybe there's something in that. But there were a lot of push and pull factors for why the Greeks migrated to Australia. Obviously, economic, and to be right, it's best economic migrants. And there was a push in the post-war era for Australia's mass industrialization and the need to recruit unskilled labor. Australia signed an agreement through the Committee on Migration with the Greek government in 1951. That really opened up those waves of Greek migrants to come to Australia. But a lot of those who did arrive were from impoverished countryside and were interested in changing their lives. It's interesting we talk about it in terms of permanent settlement, because some evidence suggests that not all Greek migrants intended to settle permanently in Australia. As economic migrants, many intend to come, make some money, and then eventually return to Greece with profit. And they did do that. We'll go back and forth. My own family, or where we ended, did settle in Australia. On my mother's side, my grandfather spent time as a guest worker in Germany without his family in the 1950s, and only in the late 60s did they decide to migrate to Australia. So, yeah, a lot of it was about economic opportunity.
It's interesting, and it's not incompatible with the relation with the transport opportunity in the early 1920s, because those population that have been transferred on the basis of the culture of Lausanne with spirit and did losing enormously economically in the process. They lost capital, so they were facing the economic conditions and were forced to leave areas and mobile. But let's keep the thread of the Greeks who moved to Australia. What are the political conditions in Australia at that moment? What are the policies affecting them?
The short answer is there weren't policies or structures and services in place to receive and settle new migrants from outside the British Isles. And migrants from the UK and from Ireland always, for instance, in that post-war era, the line from the Department of Immigration Minister was that for every one non-Briton, there'll be 10 from Briton. And of course, the numbers weren't there. That wasn't possible. So when they were received, they were told to be Australian, to assimilate seamlessly, to abandon their prior political and ethnic outlooks, to leave that in the old world, because now we're now in the new world, and to assimilate. So they were labelled new Australians, and this was also the line that was used for remote mass immigration from Southern Europe to the Anglo-American population. The idea that they would become new Australians, stop speaking their languages, and seamlessly integrate into society without much need for investment in social services and welfare. And of course, that didn't happen. Greek communities in particular, and the Greek diasporas in their other examples in the world, formed their own societies, fraternities, regional brotherhoods, but were very strong.
A question about that. I would have thought the opposite, so that it's precisely this intention to have them assimilate the library registrars, who there are more spiritual services to them than just let them come and it keeps their islands and language.
Well, that's the interesting irony about, I don't even know if it's all assimilation policy, because there wasn't really any targeted investment in what assimilation would mean, as in there were some English language training programs, but they weren't mandatory and they weren't very well enforced. So assimilation essentially translated to basically the government saying we don't have to invest in special services for these new migrants. That would almost be an outlier in the whole philosophy of assimilation. The idea was that institutional structures in Australia shouldn't have to change for these incoming migrants, which is, from a retrospective historical perspective, ridiculous, given the mass numbers that were coming in. The idea that structures and systems wouldn't have to change to accommodate new migrants. That being said, the Department of Immigration was a brand new department within the government. It not existed before 1947. That bureaucracy expanded exponentially in the 1940s and 1950s. But we have the Good Neighbour Council, which was run by good-intentioned Britons trying to indoctrinate new Australians in an Australian way of life. It was ill-defined what it meant to be an Australian other than ascribing to broad civic values that aligned with British conceptions of public life. So in terms of targeted specific welfare programs for incoming non-English speaking migrants, there was very little.
So how was an expectation that they would become like the dominant offspring type in terms of habits, language? What was the expectation that they were not ready to spend? What was the mechanism they intended to have them become live, the dominant?
Well, I think they were willing to accept that the first generation would be difficult. They were funneled into factory work, instead, unskilled labourers. The expectation was that their children would become Australian. Simply by
school system.
Yes. So they were in schools like other children and expected to not speak their ethnic languages in public, and seamlessly integrate into the mainstream.
So they were expected to become like standard Australian type after the one generation. And in the meantime, for the migrants, for power seeking, they would be tolerated as different, but with the expectation that children will not continue along that path.
And would abandon, basically, their cultural heritage. Yeah.
So those towards this objective of a unified, culturally unified country, without spending for
living costs. I mean, we have to understand that Australia, since Federation and before that, during colonisation, ongoing practices, but that it was overwhelmingly Anglo-Celtic. We're talking about 95% of the population having British heritage. There were sectarian conflicts, and often the post-war immigration boom tends to shadow that history of sectarian violence that occurred pre-World War II, and that tension between English and Irish settlers in Australia. That was a big blitz ethnically in Australia prior to World War II.
Okay. And then here, when we talk about assimilation, we are talking about language. Are we talking also about religion?
Well, that's
Boston singers that were political views.
It's hard to talk about Australia and religion. I'm not saying things like the Catholic Church don't have a lot of power within Australia, but in terms of how it's implicated into a sense of nationhood and identity, not really the case. Greeks were free to establish their Orthodox churches within Australia, as they did during the 19th century as well. So I think religion has never featured very much in conception.
So they were expected not to reproduce in Australia the kind of church-state connection and abuse.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
So after that, what most people at the time?
Yeah, I mean, a sizable Catholic minority because of the Irish, obviously, and then the Italian migration contributed to that in interesting ways, but predominantly Protestant. Definitely our leaders were.
And what was this assimilation also meant when they specific political views, especially foreign policy views? We know that Australian foreign policy has remained very close to British foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
The Greeks were not coming with a completely different mindset. Mm-hmm. Greece has been never independent of the UK for a long time in history. But while there's the notion that the dominant foreign policy orientation of the country should not change, based on this immigration, that the dominant relationship between the British and, but to some extent, the New West.
Of course, and definitely after World War II, our foreign policy orientation definitely skewed more to the US and the UK. This is a long history of anxiety about our geopolitical location in the world and our proximity to Asia. There's always been that the settler colonial state looked towards the motherland. It was expected that immigrants that did come from outside the British Isles would abandon a lot of their politics. We're also talking about the Cold War era. So immigrants were screened as well. I'm not saying that there wasn't a sizable number of left-wing and communist migrants that did eventually settle in Australia, but they were under scrutiny and definitely not allowed to have any say in foreign policy, definitely not in the post-war era.
And then Greece banned with the Western side, the Cold War. There was the Greeks' deal war was between communists and party. That did you could fear that sizable proportion of Greek immigrants in Australia would still maintain some communist views, which would be dangerous in the context of the Cold War. But there was expectation from the government in Australia that Greek immigrants were not promote communist views.
Yeah, and it was interesting. The migrants, the subset of Greek migrants that were active in the left-wing politics in Australia were under severe scrutiny from the Australian Security and Intelligence Organisation right up until 1975 when they were selected. They were repeatedly denied their citizenship applications to Australia because of their ties to the Communist Party of Australia, a legal party. So all of that I find quite fascinating.
Yes, so and this leads to the matter of the political conditions that Greeks found when they arrived in Australia, which is that Australia set up, as you mentioned, this Department for Immigration in 1940, set up as a result of fear of Hitler's invasion during World War II, and then said that scarcely populated country like Australia could be in difficult pain in case of large-scale invasion from an Asian power. So they realized that they needed to pull from other countries than the UK to reach the critical demographic mass that would enter them to resist insertion ban, be it an aggression from Japan or another North Asian economy, or capital of China, perhaps yet at that time. I mean, 1997, but shortly after the wars.
Mm-hmm.
So, am I correct in thinking that the Australian government was willing to take immigrant processes of Europe as a potential contribution to more populated Australia, while avoiding to take migrants that could be a liability in the event of the major conflict in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, I mean, historically, Australia's always had pretty stringent screening processes when it comes to immigration. You talk about the White Australia policy. But that demographic need, as you said, for the mass immigration to increase the population in terms of defence strategies was a factor related to fears around invasion from the Japanese during World War II. But that motivation for defence very quickly took a backseat to the need for labour, industrialisation, the need to boost the quality of rations tied quite closely to an economic mission. And we're talking about governments that have very close ties to industry and manufacturing, as well as trade unions, so that it was a balancing act between all those forces as to which migrants were willing to accept. And initially it was, as I said, very racialized and about suitable British settlers. The categories had to be expanded to meet that demographic need. And that initially meant Northern Europeans, but of course Northern Europeans didn't want to migrate at that time to Australia. The category expanded again to Eastern and Southern European migrants. But they were also, as I said, politically screened. They would be, appropriate settlers.
Do you think that this political screening really affected the composition of British? That is, in the absence of this political screening, would we have seen more immigration, for instance, from Indonesia or other Southeast Asian nations?
I think it goes hand in hand with the whole racial selectivity of Australian immigration policy.
So they had an impact on those groups?
Yes, definitely.
Well, do you think as well that Europeans could move to Australia, even though Europe is a much farther away? Also, because there were international organizations paying for the transfers of Southern Europeans, what has become today an international organization. Immigration was initially subsidized by the United States to pay for the join of migrants from Southern Europe to other countries like Australia. So you could think that in this way, Southern Europeans were able to go into Australia, and perhaps some Asian migrants just didn't have the funding to go to Australia. Do you think they would have had, and it's the policy of selectivity of the different government that prevented a bigger wave of Southeast Asian migrants to the country?
Yes. I mean, this period of time that we're looking at is quite controversial that Australia was still standing by its white Australia policy. Right up until the mid-1960s, ministers for immigration were defending Australia's right to keep out non-European, speaking broadly, non-European migrants, and there were severe caps. In the late 1940s, there were even caps on Jewish immigration to Australia. So there was a strong spread of anti-Semitism here as well. There were caps on Polish immigration at one point, for example. So Australia's always been fairly racially selective in who it will allow into the country. When it came to Asia, it was always tied to our anxieties about, and I'm quoting you from the hysteria that we often hear in the source material about the hordes from them, and the fact that Australia at that time saw itself as a isolated British outpost. So it was about stemming the tide, to quote this little, stemming the tide of Asian immigration. It was only from the mid to late 1960s that some of those strict stipulations in the white Australia policy were relaxed to allow in Asian students in the Philippines, from other parts of Southeast Asia, to come and study within Australia, not necessarily to settle and take up citizenship, because they always had different rights to apply for citizenship than European migrants. So definitely it was about controlling the demographics of the Australian population.
I see. So they had some success about that, at least until, as you say, the late 60s or 1970s. I would think that from the 70s onward, as you say, the olds from Asia were probably even more able to move to Australia because of development, the region. So there wasn't a policy, but there was a stronger push, which meant that quite a sort of policy was bigger. But let's stick to all Greek migrants in Australia. And you suggest that the Greeks upset the expectation that they would just nicely fit into an Anglo-Semitic country. They were able to disrupt some of the political system, you suggest, and win more influence than they were expected to.
It's interesting that it wasn't expected that such a large number of immigrants that were encouraged to take up citizenship wouldn't have voting power, and how slowly it took the Australian establishment to recognise the power of ethnic vote, in my historian's mind, is quite remarkable. In my work, at least, I look at that subset of left-wing migrants that did make demands of government structures and systems throughout the 1950s, 60s and 70s, and did eventually have an impact on settlement services. Now it's a little cliche to talk about the ethnic voice, the ethnic lobbying group that adheres to Southern European migrant groups that have infiltrated some of those systems of power today, particularly in terms of their lobbying and the amount of funding they get from state governments for various cultural reasons. From the grassroots level, it did start, internally. Their communities were isolated and there was a need to provide for each other in terms of housing and employment. And then much later on, as they became Southern and Eastern Europeans, the bulk of the industrial working class, it was about demands made to trade unions and then in turn to government structures. Yeah, in many ways, you can see that happening.
And always they need to expand their influence in the Australian political system. So you have a lot of the ending votes, that is just by the large number. And the fact that they would not assimilate as expected, it meant that there was some political demand for different policies than traditional policies. So it could affect domestic politics, then it could also affect foreign policy. So this group of people did not necessarily exist, and their preference would become very much similar to those of the Anglo-Saxon population. So then was this taking hold? Was there another instrument of influence than the vote?
Yeah, in terms of their power within trade unions, and that was growing throughout the 1960s and 70s, certainly. And we have to think in terms of the context in that post-war era and the power of trade unions then, which is not what it is today, and in terms of membership and Australia's reliance on manufacturing at that time. In terms of the Greek diaspora, we also have to consider the influence of an Australian educated generation that coming through in the 1970s, those who had been educated in Australian university, coming through as rising professionals in the fields of law, medicine, welfare work as well. And a lot of those key individuals as well played a role in forming societies that made demands for government as well, particularly in reforming legal systems, making demands of social welfare in terms of translation and interpretation, and demanding changes to healthcare as well.
Okay. I said that what we saw emerging then, an alliance between these groups of people and the government, insofar as they will lobby the government so that the government intervene more for them. Because they face a number of problems with the state that's structured, and so they request, as you say, social services, translation services, adaptation, and so these groups become proponents of more state intervention to accommodate them into society. You mentioned earlier in the conversation the growing bureaucracy that follows the creation of the Department of Education in 1947. So this bureaucracy and the government at large understand that it has a job to play with those people to accommodate them in Australian society. So initially there was expectation they would assimilate. They don't. As expected. And so to overcome this misexpectation, we have an alliance between these groups and the government to expand social services in their favor. And so the government bureaucracy is arranged in favor of that because it allows them to grow and provide more services.
Yeah, well, essentially what they were demanding, though, were deeper structural changes to the way governments accommodated difference, right? that expanding bureaucracy that you mentioned in the Department of Immigration was all geared to that initial 2 years of settlement. None of it was really a recognition that the demographics of Australia completely changed and that therefore we needed to rethink what it meant to be a British society. So essentially what some of these migrant rights activists in the Greek diaspora were arguing for was a complete renegotiation of what the state, of who the state should serve and what it should look like. In terms of welfare services, that meant recognising that ethnicity wasn't just a kind of a temporary state of mind that a community would naturally grow out of after that first generation of settlement, but rather that it was something that could be woven into society.
And this gives a vocation to the government to create this particular trust.
There are arguments, yes, that grassroots kind of demands was what's been on the government to embrace a more multicultural framework. Settlement services, but also new access and equity frameworks.
Were former Greeks turned Australians, even perhaps the second generation, able to really infiltrate the political system?
There's some interesting arguments in the 70s at the very local municipal level when it came to council elections around some populations, some suburbs in Melbourne, even in the northern suburbs. 20-30 of residents in those suburbs were Greek-speaking migrants, which is huge. And yet many of them weren't voting in local elections. They either weren't properly informed or didn't feel able to participate, or the candidates that were up for election didn't really represent their interests. And that only slowly began to change after the 80s and 90s. But if we look at local and state politics and government today, it is definitely more representative of those communities and what they actually look like on the ground. I don't know if I can say the same for the federal politics, but certainly the local level, we do participate more readily in politics and are able to. But there are many problems around the kind of structures that prop up multiculturalism and who gets aided to actually participate in politics.
Are there prominent Greek origin politicians in Australia? People who are my age, who reach various positions in the Australian political system and favor a more intervention state to promote the rights of these migrants.
Greek Australians today, we would say that they have definitely achieved a level of representation. Whether or not they use that platform to in turn advocate structures that help new and older migrant groups is a different story, but definitely they are represented at all levels of Australian politics today. And you could see the case of Italian immigrant communities as well, and other Eastern European migrant groups, less so for non-European Australians today, less represented in politics, but definitely Greek communities within Australia do have a lot of lobbying power as well, particularly at the state level in Victoria, Melbourne being the second or third largest Greek city in the world. And politicians on both sides, Labour and the parties, are very much aware of the strength of the Greek community.
And do they advocate for proactive policies in favour of Greek immigrants or other types of immigrants?
It's a question of what the Greek community needs now. It's not the same as what perhaps they need when they were more disadvantaged to working class cohort in the 70s and the 80s. We're talking about a community arguably from the 90s that gets to more middle class lobbying group and has achieved some measure of social mobility. But what that means in terms of whether or not we Greek Australians feel a responsibility to continue to advocate for multicultural services that help newer or other disadvantaged minority groups.
What's the any form of backlash in Australian politics against foreign residents and the cause of the multicultural society?
Habitually, yes, it'll come up in the mainstream news cycle. Particularly in the 80s, we had a number of very well-publicised debates about whether or not multiculturalism is good for the country. A number of more conservative politicians and historians made public claims that, that multiculturalism had failed Australia, that we were going too fast. But their concerns were primarily around
But
there were concerns around the rate of Asian immigration, for example. But an interesting thing happened in the 90s under John Howard. He was never in favour of multiculturalism, but resisted using the word too often, but also somehow rhetorically managed to decouple a pride in multicultural Australia from this issue of immigration intake. And it's an interesting irony in Australian today that, that we can hold simultaneously this idea that we're a successful, harmonious, multicultural nation and yet demonise asylum seekers who arrive by boat, and that the political establishment and voters across the board can be in favour of multiculturalism and at the same time in favour of harsh deterrence measures towards asylum seekers and refugees. It's an interesting irony in Australian politics that I think evolved from the 90s.
Because in Australia, it's
quite easy, and this happens in the UK as well, to demonise the burden of refugee and asylum seeker costs for the state. In Australian terms, we've never received that many asylum seekers or refugees, and they've never been a burden on the state in terms of welfare. If anything, Australia needs those migrants to contribute economically, but also to fill massive skills gaps in care services as well. So the economic burden of refugees and asylum seekers, but also other assisted migrants, has never been a reality in data.
So this was the journey of Greek migrants into Australia, how they came for a mixture of economic and political reasons. They can create a way to play in this political dance with the editing vote and the failure of the initial expectation that it would just be like the others. Some alliance between the government and the peasant groups to foster bigger bureaucracy and bigger intervention and create this multicultural society and some backlash in African politics about the benefits of all this. So it rings bells with other cases of immigration in Europe as well. We have similar cultural debates, whether the influence doesn't have too much for immigrants, or whether immigrants should assimilate into European society. I think what this is shows is having consistencies of all those policies. That's both policy related to the expectation of total assimilation and the policies of multiculturalism, because both do not turn out flat. A specific case of that, for one that is windy and enormous, which is the Jewish diaspora. You can make the argument that the Jews were able to the most important powers in the world in the 20th century, the UK, and the USA. Do you see the Greeks like this Jewish diaspora being able to influence Australian
people? No. In small matters, it's not as heated and politicized in terms of the Greek diaspora in Australia influencing relationships between Australia and Greece and foreign policy. The issues aren't as high stakes. The Australian nation state has a contentious relationship, I suppose, with its Jewish diaspora. Definitely today, at least, the Israeli lobby in particular and its influence on Australian politics is obvious in the way that the current war in Gaza is being reported on and how politicians are talking about it or not talking about it, but also the fact that Australia is selling arms to the Israeli state today. And it does speak to the strength of the Israeli lobby in Australian politics today. But I don't want to get that all tied up into different waves of the Jewish diaspora in Australia, which is diverse and different and certainly not all aligned with the Zionism of the Israeli state. The Greek diaspora, I wouldn't say that they have a huge amount of influence on broader foreign policy objectives of the Australian government, but definitely they have some lobbying power today.
More in terms of domestic politics.
Yeah, and there's some, if you isolate some policies, I'm thinking the really lengthy negotiations that happened around all the tensions between the Greek government and the Australian government. There's a lot of work done there. Compensation cases in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. The Greek diaspora in Australia, those migrant community groups played a big role there.
Perhaps slow this as we do in the fact the screening was already done, if I may say, shows that is the group, then the Delta, for instance, if she's just somewhere else. Which could be different from those of Australia.
Okay.
We are, most of them along the Western Alliance.
Well, those kind of communist migrants I mentioned before who were denied citizenship, they lobbied the government quite hard in the 60s and around issues to do with democracy in Greece. They protested Greek ships stopping in Australian ports. They were asking for boycotts. So they were quite active. They didn't really have many results in terms of their influence over Australian foreign policy, but they were active and on the streets and protesting around these issues to do with Australia's relations with the Greek nation state.
The difference with the Jewish diaspora is that there is less of a case for geopolitical actions specifically, and also Australia is not as big as the US. It's not a bright power in the international system.
We're a middling power, but the fact that we are contributing in our own way to the horrors that are currently occurring in Gaza is enough for us to try to resist that and talk about it. Yeah.
So, saying that there are different types of diasporas, that is, you have geopolitical diasporas that are really meaningful to influence foreign policy. And you have more strictly domestic politics diaspora that are going to lobby the government to receive social services, to receive forms of preferential treatment, to help them integrate and create a society. Can we make an apology of that?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yes, of course we can. And many scholars have attempted to make these typologies of different diasporas, right? Like some of the earliest, I'm thinking of, I can't remember saying, but trying to separate an elite diaspora that had access to funding capital versus a more proletarian kind of working class diaspora that maybe didn't have that same access to power. But that's not to say one can't become the other. And it also depends on their access to citizenship as well. If we look at, for example, the Chinese diaspora in Australia today, many of them are permanent settlers. Not all of them will have the same access to citizenship or even choose to take up Australian citizenship, and yet they are permanent residents. What does that mean for their ability to advocate for their interest in terms if they can't vote on? But we're in a different kind of mobile world in many cases. What does it mean to raise a family transnationally in Australia if you're not a citizen, which many in the Chinese diaspora do? These are new questions that we should be asking. In Australia.
You think the Chinese diaspora is more interested in influencing the government on domestic affairs? Is that on a point for this?
I haven't done research or reading.
Because that was being created on the 40s, 50s, and so on. The future would be that the immigrant communities would be able to keep the balance of foreign policy in favor of the Asian nation.
Not seeing that for yet. Well, Australia's political relationship with China is a tricky one, and it does depend on the strength and the number of the diaspora within Australia.
That correlates to what we were saying earlier, that Australia is not the US, in the sense that you can have a diaspora exerting enormous geopolitical influence in a country, if and only if that country is a main potential actor.
Yeah.
So the more that government going be extending and intervening in international affairs, the more there is an opportunity to use that law. The fact that Australia is obviously an important ally to the US and the UK, and so then we have this active foreign policy actually for the power, but it's more of a standing in the power, which is not going to show its way in various debates in the region, and I call the powers to do that. Could explain why there is not much room for influence on geopolitical matters, even if we're about a data gallery, for instance, in Europe.
In many ways, we have to toe the line, right? Because we've always sought to have powers like the UK or the US as our big brother protector within the region. And yet today, most of our exports go to China, and we're quite reliant on that as economically. Even in the last year or so, the kind of issues with exports and previous Liberal government's tense relationship with the Chinese government has put us in a difficult position that's being repaired at the moment. But at the same time, we're very palpably aware of the need to align ourselves with the US foreign policy. It puts us in a tricky position. But I'm not a foreign policy expert, so I can't really comment on that.
Oh, no, I mean, from the point of view of the diaspora, that's so you need to do this, it's more on the export structure than the immigration that explains why Australia is bound to become an increasing leader and member of the so-called five-eyed group, because it's losing tied other Asian countries.
Yeah, well, it's my opinion that we're not talking enough about what it means to have this resident population that is not taking up citizenship, that has different rights within the nation state, but still has ties to, if we're talking about a large diaspora group to China, what that means for us politically and whether or not that diaspora has an influence and how we deal with that. I don't think that's something that we've really talked about and tackled. The temporary migration to Australia of guest workers seems weren't really a factor in the post-war era, and only since the 19th have we set up the temporary visa categories that have just exploded since in the 1990s, that we have this massive kind of vast population that I think politically we haven't quite reckoned with.
And do you see any demand for diaspora expertise one there? That is government and of immigration countries, for instance, or even some companies, maybe federal companies from some countries that would be interested in understanding better how diaspora politics can work and how diaspora can use to increase that influence in a particular country. Do you see a demand for better in that field?
As a historian of the diaspora, I would say yes. And then I know periodically Greece becomes interested in utilising the power of its diaspora, cultural or economic reasons. I'm particularly interested in what it can mean culturally and historically. Definitely, given the increased mobility of the world in which we live, it only makes sense for us to unpack these ideas around the diaspora and actually mean. Like, I've talked a lot about these concepts around belonging. But as a real structural and social reality, what does that mean for individual and collective members of the diaspora? I think there's a definite need for expertise in this area.
But by governments or by private companies?
Obviously, it should be coming from both. Right? Yeah.
So you may have a point, let us say, a great shareholders who would be interested in leveraging on the influence of the Green Diaspora in Melbourne, perhaps get some preferential treatment.
Sure, yeah.
And likewise, we know that Greek policy is very much brought by the relation with Turkey. So you couldn't imagine the Greek government trying to leverage some trends of the Greek global Melbourne to make sure in the various issues between the two countries, Australia takes the side.
Yeah, I mean, at the last census, we're talking about over 400,000 of Australians who claim Greek ancestry. It's not a small group of people.
It shows how complex and interconnected world comes. But I think, and I will let you continue on that, I think that this interconnected world and this power play of around diaspora communities are strictly proportional to the development of the government in a particular country. That my intention about the story that is, because some people will say all diaspora are risks, especially if you think in terms of democracy, diaspora can leverage Korean experience in your country and expand and development in other areas. Turn or foreign policy direct. So my understanding is that it can happen, yes. But it's also proportional to the development of the government in America. We're making this comparison between Australia and the US in terms of foreign policy. That is, the more expanded the government here in a particular country, then the more likely it is that various lobbies, including diaspora lobby, are going to get something out of that government. Would you agree with this view?
Yeah, I would. I just can't happen on any kind of example within the Greek diaspora, within Melbourne at least, just because my research is quite localized in many ways. And less looking at that kind of transnational diasporic lobbying power that you're kind of talking about. And I get the real kind of European fear almost of the growing power of some diaspora groups doesn't really translate as much into the Australian setting. Yeah.
So thank you very much, Alexandra. So do you like to tell our listeners where they can follow your work and follow you?
Sure. I'm on Twitter. I'm at Aleka Dell on Twitter. I do also have a blog that's linked in there. Otherwise, you can just search me. I'm at the Australian National University, and I'm accessible via email.
Okay. Thank you very much, Alexandra, for your insights.